Matthew, chapter 2, verses 13 through 15, Out of Egypt. The fourth talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on March 22, 2015, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
Today we're going to look further into chapter 2 of Matthew. In particular, we're going to look at one particular Old Testament quotation that Matthew gives. I said last week that we were going to look at three. I was insane. We're going to look at one today. A number of times, Matthew will quote an Old Testament passage and then say it is fulfilled by something that he's talking about, some event in the life of Jesus. And it's often quite difficult to tell what Matthew means. In fact, in some cases, his statements seem to make no sense at all. How in the world are we to see this event in the life of Jesus fulfilling this Old Testament passage that doesn't seem to have anything to do with it? When Matthew uses the Old Testament, it's like a delicious fruit with a very thick and hard rind. I believe that Matthew is saying something important and profound about Jesus, but it is not easy to get at. You have to solve the problem of getting through this thick rind. Speaking very frankly, this presents a very difficult problem for me as a teacher. In order to discover Matthew's point, we're going to have to talk about issues of interpretation. There are choices that must be made, and I have to explain to you what choices I have made. That way you can evaluate for yourself whether I have gotten anywhere close to what Matthew intends. In other words, in order to get at the delicious fruit inside, I am going to have to give you a lesson on kitchen techniques. How do you cut through such a thick rind? And perhaps I should warn you that my knife skills are not very good. A few days ago, I was slicing an onion and ended up slicing my thumb instead. So, I don't know, maybe you should stand back at a safe distance here. Our passage for today is Matthew 2, 13 through 15. Now, when they had gone, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him." So Joseph got up and took the child and his mother while it was still night and left for Egypt. He remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Matthew's referring to a passage from the prophet Hosea, Hosea 11:1. "When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." We're going to look more at this passage in a minute, but right now I just want to highlight the problem that we face here. The prophet Hosea is pronouncing a word of judgment on the northern kingdom of Israel. Soon the Assyrians are going to come and totally destroy them. In the midst of this message of judgment, God reminds Israel of the Exodus. He reminds them that, through Moses, God had rescued them from bondage in Egypt, had led them out of Egypt. Hosea 11:1 is talking about the past, about the exodus of Israel from Egypt. God says, "When Israel was a youth, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." Back in the time of Moses, just to make this really clear, God called his son, the nation of Israel, out of Egypt. That is what Hosea is talking about. And yet Matthew is saying that the events surrounding Jesus being taken to Egypt fulfill this passage. No one would argue that Hosea is making a prediction about the future Messiah. Hosea is making a statement about God rescuing Israel from Egypt in the past. And yet Matthew is saying that this Hosea passage is fulfilled in the life of Jesus. So that's the problem. That's what we're going to have to sort out. What is Matthew doing with this passage, and how can he be doing it? Before we look at the passage specifically, I want to explain to you how I approach this problem. As I've been thinking about this issue over a number of years, there are certain decisions that I have made, and I want to spell them out for you so you understand the decisions that I'm going to make when we look at this passage. Decision number one, I trust Matthew. Matthew is not stupid or deceptive. It only takes a few seconds of reading in Hosea to see that God is talking about Israel leaving Egypt in the past. I cannot believe that Matthew does not know that. Matthew gives evidence of knowing the Old Testament pretty well. So whatever Matthew is doing, he does know, he knows as well as we do, that Hosea was talking about Israel in the Exodus under Moses. That is my first assumption. I trust what Matthew is doing. He's doing something that we don't know what it is yet, but what he's doing is not deceptive or stupid. He understands what's going on in this passage. My second decision is I believe that we have to learn what the word fulfill means by observing how it is used. And in particular, in each case, when Matthew says that a particular passage is fulfilled, we have to try to sort out, well, so in this case, what sort of thing does he mean? The word translated fulfill means to fill up, to bring to fullness, various things like that. And yes, sometimes an earlier prediction can be brought to its fullness by coming true. We saw one example of that in Matthew. A prophet predicted that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem. And then that prediction, we can say, is fulfilled. Although, funny enough, Matthew does not use that language for this passage. This prediction is fulfilled, is brought to its fullness by actually coming true. The Messiah is born in Bethlehem. So there's a prediction, and then it is fulfilled by coming about the way it was predicted. But as we look at the way the word is used, especially by Matthew, but in various places in the New Testament, there are clearly other things besides predictions that can be brought to fullness. The significance of an early event can be brought to its fullness, for an example. So what we will try to do is observe what Matthew is doing as he uses this word fulfilled. And I think it has different kind of flavors each time he uses it. Each time he uses it, it's a little bit different. My third decision, I believe that Matthew expects his readers to know the Old Testament, or at least to go back and look into the passages that he's using. But really, I think, to know the Old Testament. We saw this when we looked at the genealogy that starts the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew expects us to know about the covenant God made with Abraham, the covenant God made with David, the history of Israel with the rise and fall of the throne of David, the prophetic concept of the Messiah, the Christ. Matthew expects us to know all of that. That's how the genealogy can communicate. That's how you can understand the picture that Matthew is painting, because he expects that you know about those things when you read the genealogy. And this will be true throughout Matthew. Matthew quotes the Old Testament, or he makes allusions to the Old Testament, and when he does so, he expects us to keep up. There is more going on than he explains. There is almost always more going on than he explains. The evidence is very strong that this is how Matthew operates, indeed how most of the New Testament authors operate, but particularly Matthew. So we are supposed to go back and look at the Old Testament passages. We're supposed to understand them in their context. We are then supposed to explore the connections between those passages and the life of Jesus or whatever is being talked about in the New Testament. We are not making stuff up. When we do this, we are following Matthew's intention. This is what he expects us to do. My fourth decision, I believe that there is a strong theological connection between Israel and Jesus. We see the relevance of this point in our Hosea passage when we get to looking at it. This is a passage indeed about Israel, but there is a connection between Israel and the Messiah that makes this passage relevant to the life of Jesus. Now, I want to be careful here, especially for some of you. Scholars love to debate about this sort of thing. There's a ton of discussion about this sort of identification between Jesus and Israel. Some would claim that the Semitic mindset makes no distinction between the individual and the group. What's true of Israel is true of Jesus, the Messiah. The scholars call it corporate solidarity. Matthew can take a passage about Israel and make it about Jesus because Israel and Jesus are kind of the same thing. Now, in a way, I'm sympathetic with this. I am sort of saying something like that, but I think this kind of thinking can be taken way too far. These kinds of arguments often seem kind of strange and arbitrary to me. I would describe the specific connection between Israel and Jesus like this. Israel has a unique relationship with God. Israel has a great mission and a great destiny. But how is Israel's mission going to be fulfilled? Ultimately, their mission is fulfilled through the greatest of all the sons of Abraham, Jesus the Messiah. How is Israel going to inherit its destiny of blessing and peace? Again, that blessed destiny will come to them through Jesus the Messiah. Israel's special mission and destiny finds fulfillment in Jesus. So their destinies are intertwined. Events in Israel's life have implications for Jesus and vice versa. So this connection between Jesus and Israel is based on the promises and purposes of God. From the beginning, when God looked at Israel, when he made promises to Israel, he had in mind Israel's most illustrious son, the Messiah, Jesus. And in that sense, there is a kind of theological connection between Israel and Jesus, and we will find the New Testament authors playing on this connection. And I think that something like that is happening in the passage that we're looking at today. And then my last decision, decision number 5, I believe that God, at times, orchestrated the events of Israel's life and Jesus' life to bring out this connection between them. This is the most controversial of the decisions that I have made. I haven't always necessarily thought this, but this is where I am right now. I first started thinking about this in connection with the story of the temptations of Jesus. We will see that story soon in Matthew chapter 4. Jesus spends 40 days in the wilderness. At the end of that time, Satan confronts Jesus with 3 temptations. 3 times, Jesus quotes scripture back at Satan and avoids the temptations. That much is apparent just by reading the story in Matthew. But there are things that Matthew has left unsaid. Again, Matthew expects us to know the Old Testament. Each of the 3 Old Testament scriptures that Jesus quotes comes from the same context. They come from the book of Deuteronomy. Specifically, they come from a sermon that Moses preaches to Israel. Israel had just spent 40 years in the wilderness. Now Moses is preaching to them about the lessons they should have learned while we're in the wilderness. He tells them how they ought to live when they go into the promised land. So we have a scenario where Jesus spends 40 days in the wilderness and then 3 times quotes from a sermon of Moses, a sermon that Moses gave at the end of Israel's 40 years in the wilderness. Now, we can draw 2 obvious and probably uncontroversial conclusions. Number 1, to understand the point that Jesus is making when he quotes these passages, we have to go back and look at these passages in context. But then that's always true. So that's a no-brainer. Number 2, Jesus is himself obviously thinking about the parallels between himself in the wilderness and Israel in the wilderness. I think that's pretty obviously true. It's not a coincidence that he's quoting from that sermon that Moses gives after they come out of the wilderness. But I think there is another conclusion that we can draw. God himself is the one who led Jesus into the wilderness. I think he has deliberately led Jesus into the wilderness to highlight the connection between Jesus and Israel. To be specific, where Israel was a total failure in the wilderness, Jesus has succeeded. The lessons that Israel did not learn and did not obey, Jesus has learned and has obeyed. I'm convinced at this point that that is a part of the meaning of the passage. Matthew 4 is not just a story about how Jesus quotes scripture to avoid temptation. It is that, but I think it's more than that. It is also a picture given to us by God that highlights the fact that Jesus, Israel's favorite son, Israel's Messiah, succeeded where Israel failed. And that message arises from the fact that God has orchestrated events to illustrate the connection between Israel and Jesus. So I'm giving that as sort of the first example of a place where I decided I think that is in fact what God is doing. We're meant to see the connection in that way. So let me remind you of my five decisions that I have made here. Decision number one, I trust Matthew. Number two, I believe that we have to learn what the word fulfill means by observing how Matthew uses it. Number three, I believe that Matthew expects his readers to know the Old Testament. Number four, I believe there is a strong theological connection between Israel and Jesus. And number five, I believe that at times God orchestrated the events of Israel's life and Jesus' life to bring out the connection between them. That's where I'm sitting right now. And so I'm going to apply my decisions to the passage that we're looking at here for today from Hosea. So first I want to talk about the Old Testament background to all of this, and then we'll try to see what Matthew's doing with it. The focus in this Hosea passage, the particular verse that Matthew is quoting, is on the Exodus. And let me remind you of the circumstances of the Exodus. I'm going to remind you of the circumstances of the Exodus in a very tendentious and pointed way, so you'll have to forgive me for that. Jacob had 12 children. From these 12 children would come the people of Israel. One of those children, Joseph, rescued the people of Israel from famine by bringing them to Egypt. But as the Jewish people grew in number, they fell into slavery in Egypt. God had promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that their descendants would live in a promised land, the land of Israel as we think of it now. But the Jews were far from that land, living in slavery in Egypt. God had raised up a man, Moses, to lead Israel out of Egypt and back to the promised land. But Moses had run away, living far from his people, far from Egypt. So God comes to Moses and tells him that he must go back to Egypt and confront the Egyptian Pharaoh. Moses must tell the Egyptian Pharaoh to free the Jewish people. So first, I want to look at a verse from the book of Exodus, chapter 4, verse 22. Moses is being told that Pharaoh is in fact not going to respond well to Moses' demand that he let the Jews go. So in Exodus 4, 22, God is telling Moses what he should say to Pharaoh. Exodus 4, 22. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go, that he may serve me, but you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. So God's telling Pharaoh, Israel is my son, my firstborn, but you, Pharaoh, won't let Israel go, so I am going to kill your son, your firstborn. What is of interest to us here is that God calls Israel his son, his firstborn. This is a rich metaphor that is directly tied to what we were talking about earlier. Israel has a unique relationship with God. They have a great mission and a great destiny. So let's talk about this metaphor of Israel as God's firstborn son and the sort of thing that it might mean. Because I think it's saying more than just Israel, I like them. They're my kind of guys. There's something very specific, I think, in a metaphor like this. Culturally speaking, the firstborn son is very significant. And there are at least two ways in which that was true. First, the firstborn son in a household was second only to the father in importance. The way you respond to the Son is a reflection of how you respond to the Father. If you disrespect the firstborn Son, you are disrespecting the Father. The Son may tell the servants to do something, and it is as if the Father is speaking. The Father is behind the Son, so if you respect the Father, you should respect the Son. We see this when God talks to Pharaoh. It's sort of implicit in this scenario. I told you, Pharaoh, that Israel is my firstborn son, but you wouldn't let them go. I am not going to stand for my son to be treated this way, so now judgment is coming upon you. You don't mess around with the son. Secondly, the firstborn son had the largest inheritance. There was a great blessing that came from being the firstborn son. So we can see how appropriate it is that God would use the metaphor of calling Israel his firstborn son. At least it seems this way to me. We can think of it as very much in line with the sort of promises that God had made to Abraham. Because basically, God had promised two sorts of things to Abraham. First, I'm interpreting these promises. First, Abraham and his descendants are going to be God's representatives to the world. If people bless Abraham, then God will bless them. In fact, through Abraham and his descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So Israel is like a firstborn son in that way. They have this important role in the world. The Father is behind them. When you're dealing with them, you're dealing with God. And secondly, God promised Abraham and his descendants a great blessing for themselves. Not only do they represent the Father to the world, but they have a great inheritance themselves as his firstborn son. Okay, so we're on a roll here, so I'm going to take this a step farther. I think it is very significant that much later, David is called the firstborn son of God, with a similar sort of imagery and cultural understanding behind it, I think. Not just David, but all the kings who descended from him. The Davidic kings are firstborn sons of God. David, as ruler over Israel and all the world, ultimately, in the promises made to him, speaks for the Father. So he's like the firstborn son in that he has that special role. The way you deal with him is the way you're dealing with his father who put him on that throne. And as ruler over Israel and all the world, David is the one responsible to ultimately implement the great inheritance of blessing and peace that has been promised to Israel. So David and the kings descended from David have this important relationship with God. They, in a sense, become the focus of the promises made to Abraham. The descendants of Abraham are going to have this important relationship with God that is going to bless themselves and the world. And now we focus in on David and his descendants, where those promises are becoming clearer. And once again, David and those descendants, they are the sons of God. They are the firstborn of God. The throne of David is the means by which God is going to fulfill the promises made to Abraham and his descendants. The throne of David is ultimately the means by which God is going to bring blessing to the world. And the throne of David is ultimately the means by which God is going to bring blessing to Israel itself. And now you can see the next step that I'm going to take, I'll bet. This didn't ultimately go anywhere very good. Because of the sins of the people, this promise of Israel having this unique relationship with God and being this blessing and receiving a blessing, that didn't go anywhere. Israel is not blessing all the nations of the earth. Israel is not living a life of blessing, of peace in the land that God had promised. Because of the sins of David's sons, the kings of Judah, the promise of blessing through them was gone. The throne of David was not ruling over the earth in peace. The throne of David was not bringing blessing and peace to the people of Israel. This was the situation that we find when Jesus comes into the world, that the great promises made for Israel, the firstborn son of God, and then more narrowly, David and his descendants, the firstborn son of God, this doesn't seem to have come to anything. But from our perspective many years later, this is not a surprise. We know that God never intended that the Jewish nation as a whole could bring about the promised blessing. We know that God never intended that the sons of David as a whole could bring about the promised blessing. We know that from the beginning, God intended to bless the world through one son of Abraham, through one son of David. The blessing comes through Jesus, the Messiah. And what is said of him? He is the Son of God, the firstborn. Like a firstborn son, when you are dealing with him, you are dealing with the Father. And through him, the promised inheritance of blessing will come to his people. Isn't this exactly the story that Matthew was implying in his genealogy when we looked at it at first? Jesus is son of Abraham. Jesus is son of David. The line of Jesus runs through Abraham to the establishment of the throne under David, then to the overthrow of that throne through the Babylonian captivity, and finally to Jesus, the fulfillment of all those promises. The blessings that would come to the world and to the Jewish people would come through one son of Abraham, one son of David. Okay, so that's a long spiel. What does that have to do with the Exodus? Let's get back to the Exodus. I would maintain that when God tells Pharaoh that Israel is his firstborn son, that there is a lot of richness to that idea. God was not just saying, I happen to like these guys, so leave them alone. God called Israel his son because he knew the great things that he planned to do through them and for them. Through the nation of Israel would come the greatest of all Israelites, Jesus, the Son of God. So there is a very real sense in which Israel being God's son is related to the fact that Jesus is God's son. That is all a network of promises that all hang together. So anyway, back to the Exodus. As you probably know, eventually Pharaoh did let Israel go. Israel eventually went to live in the promised land, the land of Israel. Eventually, God made David their king, but soon there was a terrible split, and the throne of David only ruled over the southern part of Israel. There was a separate northern kingdom that rejected the rule of David and his throne. There was much disobedience and faithlessness in that northern kingdom, so much so that eventually God sent the Assyrians to conquer them and take them into exile. This is what the prophet Hosea was writing about. Remember Hosea. We have to talk about Hosea. He predicted that God was going to judge the northern kingdom by bringing the Assyrians to conquer them. So I'm going to start reading with Hosea chapter 10, verse 15. And by the way, Bethel is in the northern kingdom. Israel is a name for the northern kingdom. Ephraim is another name for the northern kingdom. This is all about the northern kingdom. Hosea 10:15. Thus it will happen to you, O Bethel, because your wickedness is great. When that day dawns, the king of Israel will be completely destroyed. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. But the more I called Israel, the further they went from me. They sacrificed to the Baals, and they burned incense to images. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms, but they did not realize it was I who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. I lifted the yoke from their neck and bent down to feed them. Will they not return to Egypt, and will not Assyria rule over them because they refuse to repent? Swords will flash in their cities, will destroy the bars of their gates, and put an end to their plans. My people are determined to turn from me. Even if they call to the Most High, he will by no means exalt them. Now, I should warn you, there are translation issues in this section of Hosea, and I'm not going to go into all of that. And indeed, I'm not in a position to resolve those issues at this point. But if you saw some things that looked a little different than what you've got, that's because there are these translation questions at certain spots. Okay, so Hosea is giving God's word to Israel, and by Israel, we mean the northern kingdom. They have wickedly turned from God. They have refused to repent. So destruction is coming upon them. Now, God reminds them that at one time, he had rescued them from their exile in Egypt. But now, because of their sin, They are going back into exile. The details are a little unclear. Both Egypt and Assyria are powers at this time, so one way of interpreting Hosea is that God is going to send them into exile both in Assyria and in Egypt. Another way of interpreting what he's saying is that their exile is only going to be in Assyria, but it is as if Assyria is the new Egypt. God had taken them out of Egypt, put them back in the promised land, and now it is as if they are going back to Egypt. They're being taken from the promised land and being taken back to Egypt, only in this case, Egypt is Assyria rather than Egypt. But the idea is this, the tragic picture of at one time God brought them out of their exile back to the promised land, but now they're going back. They're going to be conquered and going back into exile again. Notice that God echoes the language of Exodus here. Moses had told Pharaoh that Israel was God's son, his firstborn. And here, as God looks back on that time, he says, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." He uses the language of son again. And yet Israel, the son, is going back into exile. Now, as is often true in the prophets, this message doesn't end with judgment. Yes, there is a great judgment coming on the northern kingdom. They will be taken into exile by the Assyrians. But ultimately, there is a note of rescue and redemption. If we keep reading Hosea at 11:8, we find God saying, "How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I treat you like Admah? How can I make you like Zeboiim? My heart is changed within me. All my compassion is aroused. I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor will I turn and devastate Ephraim. For I am God and not man, the Holy One among you. I will not come in wrath. They will follow the Lord. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, his children will come trembling from the west. They will come trembling like birds from Egypt, like doves from Assyria. I will settle them in their homes, declares the Lord." So, as I understand what's happening here, God is not going to abandon Israel to exile forever, but is going to rescue them once again, just like he did when he called them out of Egypt once before. So there will be a new exodus. One day, God will be calling them back again into the land. And I think, in the context of Hosea, that this is a way of talking about the days of the Messiah, when God will ultimately rescue Israel for all time. I don't know Hosea well. I have tried to look into this as much as I can in the time I've had to look at this. I think that that is ultimately picturing the ultimate messianic rescue of Israel. That's my best judgment at this point, but I just warn you that you might want to take that with a pinch of salt, because it is a difficult book, I think, Hosea, to sort out exactly what's going on. Okay, so that brings us back then to Matthew. Let me read Matthew from 2:13 again to remind us where we are. "Now when they had gone, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, 'Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to destroy him.' So Joseph got up and took the child and his mother while it was still night and left for Egypt. He remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" Okay. What I would like to do now is to give you my reconstruction of how Matthew sees the connection between this Old Testament stuff that we've been looking at in Hosea, looking back on the Exodus, and then what it is that's happening in the life of Jesus as Matthew has portrayed it. I want to be clear to you that there are a whole series of decisions that have to be made here, and I can't claim to have certainty that I have made all of them right. So I want to give you the picture as it makes sense to me. Remember those five decisions that I told you that I had made about how to approach this, and ultimately I will leave it to you to decide whether you think this will hang together. Matthew looks at the circumstances of Jesus' young life and sees a picture of the Exodus. In the Old Testament, there was a patriarch named Joseph. God communicated with him through dreams. Joseph protected the young nation of Israel by taking it to Egypt. But Egypt was not ultimately where Israel belonged. Egypt started out as a place of protection, but it was holding Israel back from their destined place in the Promised Land. And so God led them out of Egypt back to the Promised Land where they would fulfill their destiny. Likewise, in the New Testament, we see a man named Joseph. God communicated with him through dreams. Joseph protected the young Messiah of Israel by taking him to Egypt. But Egypt was not ultimately where Israel's Messiah belonged. Egypt started as a place of protection, but it was holding him back from the place he belonged, the land of Israel. And so God led Israel's Messiah out of Egypt and back to the land of Israel, where he would fulfill his destiny. Now, so far, Matthew could have made this connection in a number of ways. He might have just referred back to the story of the Exodus without quoting a passage at all. Or he might have quoted a passage from the book of Exodus. But instead, Matthew quotes from the prophet Hosea. And I'm inclined to think that this adds another layer to what's going on and even more resonance to what it is that Matthew is talking about. In Hosea, we see God looking back, reminding Israel of how he had led them out of Egypt. "Out of Egypt I called my son," he says. He uses that very rich metaphor of calling Israel his son. Israel had a unique place among mankind, just as a firstborn son has a unique place in the household. They had a great mission. They had a great destiny. But in Hosea, God is reminding them that their mission and destiny had failed. They were faithless and rebellious. God was removing them from the promised land and sending them back into exile, this time in Assyria. After all this time, the exodus from Egypt had come to nothing. And yet, he promises them, in the future, there will be a new exodus. God will call them back from exile, back into the land of promise. Okay, so by using the quote from Hosea, Matthew, potentially, here, has given us a further resonant connection with Jesus. Like Israel, Jesus is God's firstborn son. In fact, Jesus was always the way God intended to keep his promises to Israel, to maintain that special, unique relationship with Israel. Israel's great mission to bless the world would be fulfilled in Jesus. Israel's great promise to inherit blessing from God would be accomplished by Jesus. Jesus is the Son who brings Israel's sonship to fruition. In the story of Jesus, we see the true Son called out of Egypt back to the promised land where all the hopes of Israel would be fulfilled. And this time, in contrast with Israel, there will be no failure. This time, the Son of God will enter into the promised land and fulfill his mission. This time, the Son of God will enter into the promised land and triumph. Now, admittedly, as the story goes on in Matthew, the Messiah triumphs in a strange way. He dies. But it is a triumph nonetheless, as we come to understand the story. A faithful triumph wherein God brings blessing to Israel and the world, and thus fulfills the promise inherent in the first Exodus, when Israel was first led out of Egypt into the land of promise. This is the true Exodus. This is bringing the Son into the land to finally bring about the purposes that God had been promised from the beginning. Okay, this is how I understand what Matthew is doing with Hosea 11:1. So I want to say a few things about this, and then I'll open it up for your dazed comments. First of all, this may all seem very complicated. Does Matthew really expect us to get all of that stuff by quoting this one verse from Hosea? Really, you have to be asking yourself the question, didn't Ron just make all that stuff up? I mean, is that stuff really in there? Well, okay, obviously I'm going to say I don't think I made it up. It's possible that I did. I'm acknowledging it's possible that I did, but I don't think I did. But part of what makes it complicated is that I'm having to explain to you all of that stuff in the Old Testament in order to make these connections. If you already know the Old Testament well, then it actually is not that complicated a picture. And again, one of my assumptions is Matthew assumes that his audience knows the Old Testament well or will go to the trouble of learning the Old Testament well so that they can understand what he's talking about. If I know the Old Testament well, then I have these two pictures. In the Old Testament, Joseph leads Israel, God's precious son, into Egypt, and then God leads them out again to the promised land. But Israel fails and is expelled from the land again, waiting for that day when they will be restored at last. In the New Testament, a Joseph leads Jesus, Israel's Messiah, Israel's hope, God's precious son, into Egypt, and then God leads him out again to fulfill his destiny in the promised land. This time there will be no failure, and he will fulfill all the promises made to Israel. God is saying, as I see it, look at these two pictures. They look like each other for a reason. At first, we see the basic resemblance. Yeah, into Egypt, out of Egypt, both places. The more we come to understand the richness of God's promises to Israel, the more we see the significance of the similarity between the Exodus of Israel and the Exodus of Jesus. This simple picture of similarity becomes richer and richer the more we think about it. Now, as I said earlier, the most controversial part is my claim that God deliberately orchestrated events so that we would see this connection. And I recognize that this is a controversial claim. I understand God to have said through Matthew, look at the similarity between these two events. I did that for a reason. I'm making a point. I want you to look at that similarity and ask yourself, why did God do that? Why did he make them similar? Because I wanted you to see something. I recognize that not everyone agrees with this. There are other approaches that Matthew might have taken instead that we need to consider. Let me make up a different sort of example. Imagine that Matthew had not quoted Hosea the way he did. Instead, after telling this story of Jesus finding safety in Egypt and then being led out of Egypt back into the promised land, instead Matthew had said, "This fulfills what God said to Abraham, I will bless you and make your name great." Okay, Matthew's point in that case would be fairly simple. How is God ultimately going to bless Abraham and make his name great? He's going to do that through Jesus, the Messiah. So when God rescues Jesus by taking him to Egypt and then brings him back to the land of Israel, well, where he will fulfill his destiny, this is all a part of the process God is using to keep his promises to Abraham. So theologically, God's preservation and guidance of the baby Jesus is a fulfillment of the promises made to Abraham. It's part of how God is keeping those promises to Abraham. Is it intended to be a picture of anything? No. Is God saying, look at Jesus in Egypt. Doesn't that look just like Abraham over here? No, he's not saying that. He never intends them to look the same. Matthew would just be saying, if you understand the theology involved here, ultimately Jesus, these events in Jesus' life as a baby are part of God fulfilling the promise that he made to Abraham back here. So it's just a theological connection that he would be making. He's not claiming that God orchestrated events so that I would look at them and see one as being a picture of the other or anything like that. He's just saying, theologically, this is related to this. That could be what Matthew is doing, but I'm saying that Matthew is doing more than that. Now, let's imagine a different scenario. Now I'm going to make up a story. I am in a life and death situation. I must get to the other side of town quickly or terrible things are going to happen. But the traffic is terrible. All of the lights are red. There are cars everywhere. I cannot move. I have to get to the other side of town or terrible things are going to happen, but I'm stuck. I pray to God for his help, and all of a sudden, the traffic seems to all get out of my way. Every light is green, every car seems to have pulled over or turned down another street, and I zoom to the other side of town and I'm rescued. And so I say, wow, this is just like when God parted the Red Sea to save Israel. And it is like it. It's kind of a picture that's like that. The traffic was holding me back, preventing me from solving my problem, saving my life. And just like the Red Sea was holding Israel back, preventing them from escaping from the Egyptians. And then the traffic parts and lets me go through, and just like the water parted and let Israel go through. These pictures are very much alike. However, I am not claiming that God deliberately arranged for those two events to be alike in order that God could communicate a point. I myself see a similarity. Hey, look, isn't that like when God parted the Red Sea? But I can't claim that this was God's intention. At least, I am not making this claim myself. God may have intended it. I mean, God's the author of everything. He can do whatever he wants. But I don't know what he's doing. The only claim that I am making is that I see an interesting similarity between God parting the Red Sea and God parting the traffic in front of me so that I could get where I needed to go. So this also is the sort of thing that Matthew might have been doing. He could be saying, I see a meaningful similarity that helps me make a theological point. I'm not claiming that God intended us to make a connection between these two things and was communicating something specific in doing that, but I, Matthew, notice that there is an interesting similarity between these things, and I'm going to use that similarity to bring out the theological truths that we all know are there. So there's no questioning the theology that I'm bringing out in making this connection. I'm not really claiming that God intended the one to be a picture of the other. I'm just saying I'm going to use that picture for my own purposes. Once again, my understanding right now is that Matthew is doing more than that. That Matthew is in fact saying God put the one picture together to make it look like the other one. And he did that so that we would ask ourselves, what is the connection between Jesus, the Messiah, and Israel? Both of them being sons of God in a certain sense. So why would I say that Matthew is doing something more than that? In the end, I can't bring out the knockdown argument that's going to prove that I'm right about this. I can tell you why I look at it the way I do. Partly because the parallels are striking. We have Joseph. We have the revelatory dreams. We have the two sons of God. We have the picture of taking the son to Egypt. We have the picture of God calling the son out of Egypt back to what I'm calling the promised land, the land of Israel. Partly I see it this way because I'm struck by the fact that in this particular case, God deliberately leads Jesus to Egypt. It is an angel who says to Joseph, take him to Egypt. Now, there are reasons why Egypt would be a good place to go, but still, this was God saying, this is what I want you to do. I want you to take him to Egypt. Just as later, God will lead Jesus to spend 40 days in the wilderness. Here, God has instructed Joseph to take the son to Egypt. It's not hard for me to believe that one of God's motives was to set up the very picture that we're talking about. I believe that Matthew believes that God has orchestrated events to highlight the theological connection between Israel and Jesus. God is saying, look, these pictures are like each other. Now, why did I do that? We might ask the question, why would God do this at all? Why not just make theological statements? Why not just point out the theological connections between what God had promised Israel and how God is fulfilling those promises in Jesus? Why orchestrate history to have these foreshadowings and fulfillments? All that I can say is that to me, it seems like a viable and rewarding way to communicate. It's not the only way to do it, and God doesn't use this as a primary means of communication, I don't think. There are a lot of theological statements in the Bible, but there are also stories and pictures. These events in the life of Jesus and the life of Israel are kind of like a real-life parable. Look, this is like that. And then we are left to think about how this is like that. The danger, of course, is that we will take this all too far. Once we go down this road, how do we keep ourselves from going way too far down this road? We will start making up connections that don't exist and tell ourselves fictitious stories. So There's one way to avoid running the risk, which is to never go down this road at all. But it seems to me that ultimately all communication runs that risk. We have to, in order to make any interpretive decisions at all, make certain decisions about how we think the communicator is communicating. The goal is to be humble and submissive before the text. Let's try to follow the lead of the authors. Let's try to follow Matthew's lead in this text that we're looking at. I think, in this case, Matthew has led us to see that God has written history in a particular way. God has deliberately highlighted the theological connection between God's son Israel and God's son Jesus. And he's done this by writing their stories with strikingly similar events. Okay, so I have no idea whether you understand a word I just said, but here's your opportunity to do something, make comments or ask questions or whatever.
I just want to thank you for reminding us, though, that it came from Hosea, because I think that makes it even richer, that it's referring back to a failure of Israel's. If he had just referred to bringing Israel out of Egypt without using Hosea, I don't think it would have had the same...
Yeah, that's what's striking me as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was...
What you said about taking it too far really rings loud, because I'm way more confused than you are, I'm sure. The question, does it make a difference if we consider the Hebrew habit of quoting the first line of a larger piece, if you look at that quote?
Well, no, I don't think it makes a difference. Okay. I mean, what I'm suggesting, I know it said that that was the habit. I never quite know when people make these sorts of claims whether they're appealing to independent historical evidence that this was the habit, or if we're looking at a phenomenon like Matthew and saying, oh, this must have been their habit. Because, yes, I'm very much agreeing that Matthew is intending the one verse to be a window on a whole context of related ideas. I'm not the only person in the world who has ever suggested that that's the case. A lot of people would argue that that's the key to understanding how Matthew is dealing with the Old Testament and how the New Testament authors deal with the Old Testament. But yeah, something like that. You know, there are those stories. We've heard, I'm sure I've talked about this before, but in reading Homer's Iliad, I took it upon myself to do some reading and watching documentaries and stuff, trying to just, I thought it was a very interesting phenomenon, this sort of literature. And I saw a documentary where they were demonstrating that there is still in the world these pockets of places where storytellers have memorized these huge, long stories. And memorization was just, in a culture where you didn't have verse numbers and book chapter numbers and that sort of thing, you certainly didn't have your computer to do a search, go and do a search for me for firstborn, where, to see where are all the places that it's used in the Bible and all of that sort of thing. There is a lot of incentive for just memorizing stuff, for really learning, knowing a lot of the text so that you can call it to mind and talk about it in this way. So culturally, I think we're in a very different place, and it's not surprising that Matthew might expect that by alluding to this one thing that he could count on you having the whole thing in mind. It's beyond us. This is not the way we live, but I think it's very plausible to me that that would be the case.
To me, I noticed that he comes to Joseph again in a dream, and he says, instead of saying, Mary, wake up, he goes to Joseph. Mm-hmm. Which is, I don't know, I guess that's normal. Take the child and the mother. He doesn't say, take Yeshua. He says, take the child.
Mm-hmm. He says that several times. Yeah. Take the child
and his mother instead of Mary. Yeah. And then it says, and he remained there until the death of Herod. Mm-hmm. Which he do you think he means, Joseph or Jesus?
Do I have an opinion on that question?
It was a family outing. I'm sure it was all three of them, but... Does it make a difference?
Yeah, I think it's Joseph that he's talking about. I mean, because how he comes back is that he goes to Joseph again and tells him it's time to come back. And then he comes to him in another dream and says, no, don't go back into Judea where you were. Go back to Galilee. And that's how he ends up at Nazareth, which we'll talk about the Old Testament passages associated with that stuff next time. But yeah, The picture in this story in Matthew, I've made this comment several times, but it just seems really obvious that Joseph is the key human actor in this. I mean, God is working through Joseph. Joseph could have just dumped Mary, but he didn't, because God explains to him what's going on and he makes the faithful choice. And then he is the protector of the child and the mother. I'm going to get him out of here. We're going to stay there. I'm going to come back. Oh, we're not going to go there. We're going to go to Galilee instead.
So to take it too far.
Okay.
In Exodus, there arose a king who did not know Joseph.
Mm-hmm.
And then he became... So the Pharaoh died. They get a new king, which I understand was actually... Pharaoh had been non-Egyptian, and the Egyptians had moved back in and retaken Egypt. And so the new king was actually Egyptian, is my understanding from history.
I don't know that.
But anyway, Pharaoh dies, a new king arises, a threat against the very life of the people of Israel. But in Jesus' time, the king dies, and that's a good thing. The new guy becomes the safe place to go, whereas in the original story, the new guy was the worst place to be. So is that taking it too far?
People might say that, considering how far I took it, I have no right to make that judgment, but that would be taking it too far for me.
But Ron, you've taught us the parables, and I appreciate it, and you always say that it's an analogy, and you can always take an analogy too far. So
right.
That's
right.
Just a cautionary warning.
Yeah, it's part of the process of understanding. If there is an analogy of some sort intended by God, that there is some sort of a relationship analogous or symbolic or whatever, yeah, you can always take it too far. So the question is, what?
So is God the author or the originator of Romantic period literature? What I mean by that is, this really reminds me of reading like a great novel, say like Anna Karenina, where you read it and it's a series of events, and then you recognize upon reflection that much more is going on that this author has constructed.
Right.
And it's layered with complex meaning. And I'm seeing this verse from Hosea, you said, opens a window on this profound meaning that Matthew is using. Matthew is attempting to tell us there's way more here than you ever thought. And at least I think that's what you were saying.
Yeah, I am tempted. You may have noticed that I used the word foreshadowing several times, which is a language from modern literature. I mean, you could... Anna Karenina comes in on a train, and I won't give away the ending, but after you've read Anna Karenina, you think, this was not a coincidence that Anna Karenina came in on a train, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I am tempted to think about it in that sort of way. Well, I don't know. This is...
Isn't it interesting, though, that that's what people do? People make up stories like that, that have layers of complexity, whether it's music or any sort of great art. The face value of it is not the ultimate only value. There's something else. I'm not saying that we should spiritualize verses and make them mean things they don't mean, but why would we not think that God is using every bit of the complexity that people do?
Yeah, I want to highlight both of those things. In a way, it's weird for me to be in this position because I am like the conservative interpreter of all times. I mean, like, no one has ever accused me of going too far with anything. It's like, Ron, would you live a little? Risk going a little too far here, Ron. So in a way, this is a strange place for me to be, but I'm thinking that's what I'm seeing here. So I do very much want to be very cautious about not starting to read all kinds of stuff. Because I'm aware, I have been reading the literature on Matthew, and there are people who would try to argue that pretty much every event as Matthew portrays it in Jesus' life is intended to be a reflection and corollary of something that happened in the life of Israel. Jesus is the new Moses, and you can see it. He's baptized. This is water, like going through the Red Sea. He goes up on the mountain and gives the Sermon on the Mount, like Moses goes up on the mountain and gets the law. Jesus goes up on a mountain and glory is shining on his face, like Moses went up on the mountain in the presence of God and glory was shining on his face. How much of that is meant to be something or another? I'm still thinking about that. I may, in those places, back up and say, whoa, let's not get crazy here. But it is a question to be asked. at those spots. So I'm interested in exploring those questions. What I would say is that the thing about foreshadowing in literature is it says, oh, it's a way that the author has of indicating, I have something in mind, and I haven't told it to you explicitly. But the fact that I see those things there goes, oh, it looks to me like the author had this in mind all along. And that's the sort of thing that I'm suggesting may be possible that we're seeing, is that God is telling his story in such a way, and especially Matthew is bringing out those features in such a way as to say, see, God had something in mind with this. It might not have been apparent, but he did. I don't know. I'm still thinking this stuff through, so I don't know exactly how I would relate those things, but they are certainly sister concepts, and I'm still trying to sort out what I think about all of that. So,
I just had another comment that I don't see that it's inappropriate to be excited about the possibility that all of reality is just pregnant with meaning. There's meaning everywhere you look. Why wouldn't it be that way if reality is the story told by God?
Yeah, and I'll say amen to that. And now, Mr. Buzzkill, Mr. Conservative, let's not go wild here, will step up and say, see, the thing that has meant the most to me, this is my story, and it's probably limiting in some ways. You all know the kind of story that I, you know, where I come from and this stuff. But when I first became a Christian, weird stuff was coming from every direction. And what saved me in the midst of all of that stuff was coming to believe that there is a specific discoverable intent in the passages in the Bible, and that there are ways of thinking about human communication that will help me to find what those are. So to believe that the world is filled with meaning, I'm sure that's true. To believe that I can have confidence that I have discovered that meaning is another question. And that's where a certain caution comes into this. I'm looking at this and saying, I think Matthew is kind of flashing the lights here going, look at this. See? Isn't this what's going on? And that's why I'm kind of reluctantly coming up and saying, okay, yeah, I think that might be going on. But what I need, that connection of things that makes it, it's the preponderance of evidence that makes it likely that, yes, this is in fact what's going on. And if I haven't read the preponderance of evidence right here, then I may have gone off in the wrong direction on this stuff. But that's what concerns me. I'm not looking to come up with 350 ways you could read Exodus into Jesus' life. I'm trying to see what are the things, what are the threads and the connections that have been laid there that seem pretty clear that they're there. That's what I'm looking for. So it's a hard task, and I can't claim to have done it successfully all the time, but that's the goal. That's what I mean by not going crazy. Let's let the text tell us the story. Okay, well, thanks.